What is the state of the media and climate change? That is the subject of an expert panel assembled by the University of British Columbia School of Journalism and DSmogBlog.com. The speaker are James Hogan, a public relations expert who founded DSmogBlog to counter phony experts paid by the fossil fuel industry. Also Hadi Dalla Tabadi, professor at the Institute for Resources, Environment and Sustainability at UBC, who acknowledges that 10% of his million-dollar funding comes from ExxonMobil. Ross Gelbspan, a seasoned investigative reporter and author of Boiling Point, is on the panel, as is Chris Mooney, journalist and author of The Republican War on Science. Finally, we have Kirk Lapointe, managing editor of the Vancouver Sun, the city's largest newspaper and part of the CanWest chain in Canada. You are about to hear presentations from the speakers. It is about 50 minutes long.
As I said, good evening, everyone. I'm Stephen Ward, director of the UBC School of Journalism. On behalf of our school and our co-host, DSmogBlog.com, I'm delighted, as your moderator, to welcome you to the discussion of the state of the media on climate change. The panel is part of a week-long celebration of research at the University of British Columbia and is due in large part to the hard work of Brad Foster at External Affairs at UBC. Now, it is obvious tonight that this is an important and timely topic. I don't think I have to say much about that. Climate change and the environment are a primary concern among Canadians, recently surpassing healthcare in opinion polls. And a world body of scientists has reported recently on the growing urgency of the problem. Even diehard skeptics are coming to accept that climate change is a reality. Even the federal government has seen the swing in the polls and has sought to paint itself green. The debate now seems to be more about what our response should be as a country and as a global community. Now, our focus tonight is on the news media. What is its track record on this issue? Has the news media adequately covered this issue? Did it spread confusion? Did it give the skeptics of climate change too much play? Moreover, what about the future? What role should the news media play in the months and years ahead? And what sorts of coverage is necessary for the public to be properly informed? To help us discuss these issues, we have a distinguished panel of three journalists and writers, an academic and a public relations expert, and they are, and let me introduce them to you. First, Hadi Dalla Tabadi is a professor in the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at UBC. In 2001, he was appointed Canada Research Chair in Applied Mathematics, Integrated Assessment, and Global Change. He has held positions at Carnegie Mellon University and the Rockefeller Foundation. Hadi describes his research as an exploration into systematic thinking about energy, technology, evaluation, and policy. And one of his research projects is described interestingly as, quote, second best approaches to adapting to climate change. Ross Gelbspan, second on my left, he's actually retired several years ago after a 31-year career in journalism as a reporter. But he is a writer of two very well-known books on global warming. One is The Heat Is On, published in 1997, and Boiling Point in 2004. Now, The Heat Is On revealed that some greenhouse skeptics were receiving payments from the coal industry. And the book received national attention when President Clinton told the press he was reading it. Boiling Point was reviewed in the Sunday New York Times Book Review by Al Gore. Ross worked as an editor and reporter at the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe. As special projects editor of the Boston Globe, he directed a series that won a Pulitzer Prize in 1984. James Hogan. James founded James Hogan and Associates in 1984, and the company has grown into one of the largest public relations firms in Western Canada with offices in Vancouver and Calgary. James was awarded the prestigious Silver Anvil Award from the Public Relations Society of America in 2003 in recognition of his campaign on behalf of Capers Community Markets. On a personal note, James has generously given off his time to come to our school to hold engaging workshops on the difficult relationship between journalists and public relations spokespersons. Most recently, he is the founder, about 14 months ago, he tells me, of DSmogBlog.com. And he and that website is a co-host of this event. Kirk Lapointe. Kirk has been managing editor of the Vancouver Sun since the fall of 2003. And prior to this, he has extensive journalism experience as advisor to the publisher of the Toronto Star, senior vice president responsible for CTV News. He has been associate publisher and editor-in-chief of the Hamilton Spectator, a founding executive editor of the National Post, and general news editor of the Canadian Press when I was there. For the past 3 years, Kirk has been an adjunct professor at my school and is currently directing the online strategy for CanWest newspapers. Chris Mooney. Chris is Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine and a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. He focuses on issues at the intersection of science and politics, and he is, as you probably know him, the author of the best-selling book, The Republican War on Science. The Scientific American called that book, quote, well-researched, closely argued, and amply referenced indictment of the right-wing's assault on science and statistics, science and scientists, excuse me. Now, the format for the evening is as follows. I will ask each panelist to speak for about 5 to 7 minutes, and I'll give them a two-minute warning at about five when they've gone through five of their minutes in their presentation. And we've asked them generally just their views of the role of the media in this whole issue, very generally. So I expect a wide range of views here. And I warn the panelists that I will watch the clock closely and alert speakers when the time is up. After the five-minute talks, I probably will have a few questions to ask of them, things that occurred to me while they were speaking. And I'll also give them a chance to talk to each other if they want to respond to something that another panelist said. And then, as soon as possible, we want to get out to you and invite your questions as soon as we can. And we'll wrap up by 8 o'clock. Now, I ask you, the members of the audience, when you ask questions, to please go to those standing mics so we can hear you up here and everyone can hear you out there. I also ask you, if you would, if you don't mind, to identify yourself. And please try to indicate to whom the question is asked. Also, I ask you to please be as brief as possible. We want to get as many questions on the floor as we can. And I ask you to put a question mark at the end of your comment. Because we want questions, not speeches, please. So if that is clear, let's proceed to the five-minute discussions by panelists, and beginning with James Hogan.
So I'm going to spend a few minutes talking to you about DeSmog Blog and what we're trying to do at the blog. It was established about 14 months ago. And we have a tagline, as you've probably seen in some of the materials, of cleaning up the PR pollution that's clouding climate science. And our view was, when we started this, was that there was just a little bit too much media manipulation going on as far as mainly industry front groups that were basically feeding misinformation into the climate debate and confusing the public about climate science. This blog is based on research that started about 12 years ago by Ross Gelspan. And I wanted to just give you an idea of just tell you a story that gives you some insight into the kind of thing that we're talking about. There's a fellow named George Monbiot who recently wrote a book called Heat. It's a bestseller on climate change. He is also a columnist for the Guardian newspaper in London. And while he was working on his book, he came across a letter in New Scientist magazine. And in that letter, David Bellamy, who's a well-known science educator in the United Kingdom, was claiming that 555 of the 625 glaciers under observation by a group called the World Glacier Monitoring Service out of Zurich had been growing since 1980. So these glaciers, contrary to what most scientists were saying, were actually growing rather than retreating. And obviously this would be really important information if it were true. So Mombi had actually called the World Glacier Monitoring Service, and they told him, in a kind of indelicate way, that that was complete bullshit. That, in fact, glaciers are retreating around the world. So he started trying to track down the source of this. And he found it in newspaper articles. He found it on websites, in blogs. He looked all over online media, and he kept seeing this piece of misinformation just popping up. And he eventually tracked it down to a group called the Science and Environmental Policy Project. That is basically the homepage of a guy named Dr. Fred Singer, who at one time worked for Philip Morris and is now basically an Exxon-funded climate change denier, now that he's no longer working for the tobacco industry. So once people started to actually pressure Singer, saying, you know, why are you citing this? In fact, he was actually citing this information and referencing a 1989 article in Science magazine. Mombiot went to Science magazine. He looked through all the 1989 issues and could find no scientific article on glaciers at all, let alone any on glaciers advancing. And so people kept pressuring Fred Singer. His response was that this Mombiot guy has been smoking something. Anyway, eventually he admitted that the information was incorrect and that he was actually going to correct it and that it had been put there by some overzealous employee. Well, it turns out about 18 months after he said this, it was still up on his site, and he had actually neglected to tell this reporter who was pressuring on him on this that the overzealous employee that he was referring to was actually his wife. And this seems like a very odd kind of story about misinformation, but I assure you from the research that we're doing with DSmogBlog that this is not at all unusual. This is kind of what these folks do. Anyway, so what I'm going to show you in a minute when the computer's back up is a couple of slides on research that was done in the US that talks about the difference between the way the mainstream media is covering climate change and the way scientific journals are covering climate change. And the first study, it was done by Boykoff and Boykoff, and it covered a period between 1988 and 2002. And what they found in their research, which was of what they called the prestige press in the US, which included the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, I think it was the LA Times, and a couple of other newspapers. What they found was that about 53% of all of the articles talked about some kind of scientific report on climate change and then referenced a point of view from deniers who were representing industry groups, suggesting that that research was wrong and that climate change was just wasn't happening or it was some variation in the weather. I think I'll just go on without the slides. So there was a woman who's studies. So this is their slide. A woman named Naomi Oreskes, who's studies history of science, decided to take a look at this, and she pulled close to 1,998 peer-reviewed studies to find out if there was a similar kind of debate in the scientific literature. And if you could move to the next slide, she found that she couldn't find one single peer-reviewed publication by a scientist that was questioning the consensus around climate change. So in my view, I think it's fairly clear that the media has been manipulated on this issue, and quite skillfully. And I just wanted to move on to a couple of slides about Canadian public opinion. This is from McAllister Research that has been tracking through something called the Environmental Monitor since about 1985, Canadians' concern about environment. And as you know, you see it, read it in the papers, environment has recently jumped up as the number one issue. But if you look at a study that was just completed by McAllister in January in this next slide, you'll see that only 53% of Canadians are totally convinced that human activities are a significant cause of climate change. 31% of Canadians believe that they're only somewhat convinced. Our view is that somewhere in the midst of that 31% is the tipping point on public concern about climate change in Canada. Now, if you can give me just one more slide, I'll wrap up by telling you that, the next slide, there's a group in Canada right now called Frameworks who are doing qualitative work, very interesting qualitative work all across Canada, looking at Canadians' attitudes towards climate change. Their view is that Canadians are for a change as far as public policy is concerned on climate change, but they're vulnerable to manipulation on the issue because they're confused about how climate change actually works. So when you're confused about how it works, it's really difficult to make any judgment about what has to be done about it. Our view is that as the media has covered this issue over the last number of years as an issue of whether or not it's happening, you've basically kind of retarded the kind of evolution of public thinking on the issue and the understanding, the public understanding of how climate change works. And that has basically, that is what's stalling any kind of legitimate public policy shift on this, and is basically puts us in a situation where we're not addressing a very, very serious problem. So what we're doing at DSmog Blog is trying to shed light on these folks. We're hopeful with the most recent shift in public, in the way the media is covering climate change, that we're going to be seeing a shift in public understanding of what the problem is, and therefore a more mature view on what should be done about it. Anyway, if you get a chance, visit the DSmog Blog, and you'll get a better understanding of what we're talking about here. But I think my 5 minutes are pretty much up. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Ross, you don't have slides, Ross, so I guess you're not going to have the problem.
I am a reporter. I'm not an environmentalist. I did not get into this subject because I love the trees. I tolerate the trees. I got into the subject because I learned that the coal industry was paying a few scientists under the table to say nothing's happening to the climate. And I said to myself, if there's this cover-up going on, what are they covering up? And there went the next 10 years of my life. Those 10 years could have been spent much more productively if the mainstream press in the U.S., and unfortunately I don't have a good frame of reference for Canadian coverage, so I'm really talking about the U.S., had done a much better job on reporting on the climate issue. Unfortunately, they have done a dismal job. There are a number of reasons for this. An obvious one is that most scientific and environmental reporters are very good studies when it comes to mastering the intricacies of science, but they have no training whatsoever in following the money. As a result, they completely fail to pick up on the fact that the so-called debate over climate change was a totally manufactured creation by the public relations specialists of big coal and big oil. And that lack of some training in financial investigative reporting, I think, was one contributor, a small one, to the fact that the U.S. is about 10 years behind the rest of the world on this subject. The key tactic in this offensive by the carbon lobby's media specialists was basically to turn the ethic of journalistic balance on its head. For the longest time, the press accorded the same weight to industry-paid skeptics as it did to mainstream scientists. This was done in the name of journalistic balance. In fact, it was in evidence of journalistic laziness. The ethic of balance comes into play when a story involves opinion. Should we sanction gay marriage? Should abortion be legal? Should we withdraw the troops from Iraq? When a story involves opinion, I think a journalist is ethically obligated to give the major competing points of view its most articulate presentation and roughly equal space. But when it's a question of fact, it's up to a reporter to get off her or his butt and find out what the facts are. The issue of balance is not relevant when the focus of a story is factual. And in this case, what we know about the climate comes from more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries reporting to the UN, in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. This is about as close to truth as we humans can get. Granted, there have been a few credentialed scientists who have published in the refereed literature and minimized climate change is relatively inconsequential. In that case, I think if a journalist wants her or his story to be truly balanced, then the story should reflect the weight of opinion in the scientific community. And that means the mainstream scientists would get about 90% of the story, the dissenters would get a couple of paragraphs at the end. Today, that is finally beginning to happen, but very belatedly. Let me touch on another aspect. One of the first impacts of a warmer atmosphere is an increase in extreme weather events, longer droughts, more frequent heat waves, more severe storms, and the fact that we get much more of our rain and snow in these intense flash flood kinds of downpours. These extreme events also play a much larger portion of news budgets than they did 20 years ago. Given the dramatic increase in weather extremes, you would think that journalists covering these stories would include a line that says something like, scientists associate this pattern of violent weather with global warming. They don't. A few years ago, I asked an editor at a major news network why, given the increasing incidence of natural disasters, they didn't make this connection. He told me, we did that once. I said, what do you mean once? He told me that they did it, I think, when there was a very big flood in Mozambique in 2000. And he said that after the network suggested a possible link between global warming and this extreme event, several representatives of the automobile and gasoline companies threatened to withdraw their advertising from the network if they continued to make this connection. What journalists are dealing with here is a titanic clash of interests. The real solution to the climate crisis, which is cuts of 70 to 80%, threaten the survival of one of the largest commercial enterprises in the history. This is an immense drama of uncertain outcome, and it should be red meat for journalists. But the pressures inside newsrooms are intensifying as well. With the acquisition of many news outlets by a small group of conglomerates, content is increasingly determined by the profit-driven demands of Wall Street. Significant news is sacrificed for more celebrity coverage, more self-help articles, more trivial medical pieces to attract more readers and advertisers. In short, too frequently, news judgment is increasingly being replaced by marketing decisions. In the last couple of years, for example, three of the world's leading climate scientists have declared that we are either approaching or have already passed a point of no return in our ability to stave off climate chaos. How many news consumers do you think know as much about that as they do about the father of Anna Nicole Smith's baby? Internally, these same financial and corporate pressures are forcing news outlets to cut staff and deny reporters the time they need to thoroughly report complex stories. What I'd suggest to counter this trend, given the magnitude and urgency of the climate crisis, is that editors and reporters across the board assume much more of a sense of ownership of this story. There are enough aspects to the climate crisis, scientific findings, weather events, technology developments, oil industry movements, diplomatic tensions, terrorism and security issues, economic concerns, that this story should be in the paper three times a week. Rather than being ghettoized as a subbeat of environmental reporters, the climate issue should be integrated into all areas of coverage. At the level of professional responsibility, I think there's a deeper betrayal of trust here by the media. By now, most editors and reporters have heard that global warming could have potentially catastrophic consequences. Given that warning, I think it's profoundly irresponsible for a reporter to pass along the story with some counterposing quotes without doing enough digging to satisfy herself or himself as to the bottom line gravity of the situation. Their assessment certainly needn't be the same as mine, but simply to treat this story like any other without making the effort to reach an informed judgment about its potential gravity is a profound violation of the trust of readers and viewers who assume a background of informed interpretation on the part of their news providers. Ultimately, the media's job is to tell the rest of us the truth. In this case, the truth is ugly and scary. Even though I think there's an underpublicized but highly promising prospect in a cooperative global project to rewire the world with clean energy. But ultimately, the press is our early warning system. And if nature catapults us into a catastrophic situation, we will suffer far more devastation for not having prepared ourselves because our early warning system did not exhibit the intellectual integrity, the professional independence, or the moral courage to tell us the truth. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ross. And now I'll call on Hadi to come up.
So good evening. Could I please, pretty please, in the world of Lord Gates, have my slides. Thank you. Okay, so before going into this, a kind of truth in advertising, I graduated 23 years ago. In that period, I've been successful in fundraising to the tune of about $1 million a year. Of that, 80% comes from federal granting agencies like the National Science Foundation. 10% comes from the Electric Power Research Institute, which is the body, the nonprofit body that conducts research on behalf of the electricity industry, and 10% has come from the ExxonMobil Education Foundation. So I'm one of those evil people. One of the people who, I gave a talk in Washington State University last month, December, it's more than a month ago, years just been flying. And the mere fact that I'd accepted ExxonMobil Foundation money was sufficient for all my work to be invalidated. And the interesting thing is that as far as I'm concerned, the US government hasn't been terribly active on the climate front either. So I don't think it's really appropriate to invalidate all my work because 10% of my funding came from the ExxonMobil Foundation. I think all of my work should be invalidated because the US government has done nothing either. So let's start with that. Next slide, please. So a little bit of a repetition of what Ross just went through. I'd like a hands up of people who've seen those coverage of those issues in the last month. Right, that's, you know, unfortunately a minority of you. Next slide, please. How many of you are aware that Britney shaved her head? I don't need to go any further. Next slide, please. If you want to contrast media and science, you really need to understand, you know, in the most basic sense, that the media address injustice, they promote free speech, and they sell more advertising. Scientists, they address ignorance. They have a formal process for examining evidence where there is controversy, and they get more research funding. They're both businesses, and they both work on their own ethics. So next slide, please. They have different views of what objectivity means. Initially, I didn't have such a positive sentence at the beginning. Neither is objective, is what I first put down. Each is self-serving, and both have abused one another. Certainly know that scientists who have released their, I mean, there's actually been a study showing that scientists who have released their findings to the media first instead of peer review have consistently fared better. So there's a case of that. I had an interview this afternoon with someone on the CBC, and I was saying, well, I really want to get the politicians to do this, so why don't we leak this one, right? And then I actually got the approval of the municipal government that I was going to leak it on behalf of, because the municipal government wants federal support in order to do that, right? So we all use one another, and this is not quite this black and white truth and lies and right and wrong kind of world. It's one of mutual use and abuse. Next slide, please. There's been a scientific study of how scientific issues are covered in the media. And this is what's been found quite generically, a failure to reflect qualifications that the scientists provide. I can tell you I'm interviewed on a daily basis. The number of times that the qualifications that I insist on be reflected in the article are actually reflected in the article, I can count on the fingers of one hand over the past 24 years. obfuscation of source information, so articles appear without you being able to trace them back to where the original sources were. Amplification of effects, you know, some study says that people might have health effects. The actual journalistic article says people have massive heart attacks, right? It's just better headlines. And more factual errors than there used to be. So this is a through time study of what media does. I could produce exactly the same thing for scientists. In fact, I wish I had Jim's slide about the absence of dissent in the peer-reviewed literature about climate change. The absence of dissent articles was not a sign of an absence of dissent in the scientific community. It's bloody hard to publish against it, right? So over the very period that that study was going on, there was this incredibly sore thumb in the scientific evidence about the temperature of the middle atmosphere. All the satellite data pointed exactly in the opposite direction. Why wouldn't people be able to publish about that? Because just that there is a cabal to promote one idea, there is the same in science too. This is not a pure game of, you know, white has driven snow individuals. Next slide, please. This is a great example. The man who insisted on this being published in the U.S. National Assessment of Climate Change lost his job. Why did he lose his job? Because Gore got mad. What's relevant about this graph? What's relevant is that the climate on the two sides of the Rio Grande don't differ from one another significantly. What's important is that the incidence of a vector-borne disease, dengue is a disease borne by a vector called Aedes aegypti, it's a mosquito variant, is 1,000 times higher in Mexico than in the US, and that's even though the mosquito population in the US is higher. Gore didn't want a dilution of the message that scares people to their very boots, that climate change is a major health hazard. The publication of this graph went against his agenda. I'm not a fan of Mr. Gore. I believe in climate change, but I also believe in an appropriate focus of policy. Next slide, please. You can substitute for STAR either media or science. Science and media are both businesses. Greater success comes from greater sensationalism in both cases. Caveat lector. Beware the reader. Thanks.
Thank you, Hadi. Now, Chris.
If it doesn't go backwards. So I'm the author of this, Not Deviant Ways. And I'd just like to point out at the outset of the talks that there was no conscious intention on the part of the illustrator to construct a visual pun turning on my last name in the image of the elephant. And I'm not the author of this, but we weren't trying to echo that cover image either. In Republican War on Science, I was slamming politicians, and actually mostly Republican politicians, for misusing, distorting scientific information. But I've always been interested in the role that the media plays here as well and how it might exacerbate the problem. We've heard a lot of criticism, and I think much valid criticism, of phony, quote, balance, or what I call he said, she said, we're clueless coverage by the media. Balance is a problem. It is not the only problem in how the press treats the global warming issue. And so what I'd like to do is run through some of the other problems, and I'm going to rely upon data. As a journalist, it's really cool to actually have data that I got from a colleague of mine, Matthew Nisbet, at American University, and in some cases, I actually worked on the data set as well. So first of all, let's look at the pattern of global warming coverage in two agenda-setting newspapers in the United States, the New York Times and the Washington Post. Over time, you'll see that the volume of coverage of the issue follows dramatic events rather than the ever-increasing scientific certainty that has been ascribed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to the conclusion that humans are driving global warming. And in fact, you see 1995, a very scientifically important moment was the first moment that the IPCC said that there was, I believe the language is, a discernible human impact on climate. But that's a low point for media coverage. Similarly, 9/11 and Iraq actually were a time when media coverage went down as well. So the press is covering this issue not based upon the direction that the science is going, rather it's covering it based upon political happenings. And that's something to keep in mind. And when you look at an issue that I've now done another book on, it'll be coming out later this year, the relationship between hurricanes and global warming, there's something similar that happens. This is a hurricane that I just wanted to show you. It's the Katrina of the Pacific, Hurricane Linda, just as intense, 1997. You cannot get a hurricane here in Vancouver, although I did see your downed trees over the weekend. But this one, they thought it was going towards California, so they might come someday closer than people actually think. The issue of the relationship between hurricanes and global warming, it has a long scientific history. The first major paper studied on this, published on the subject was 1987. But when you look at how the press covered it, the coverage pattern looks like the wind speed measurements of a tropical storm that meandered weakly and then suddenly hit a patch of warm water and rapidly intensified to Category 5. So you have start to go up when four hurricanes hit Florida, then Katrina, not surprisingly, prompts a media feeding frenzy. And then, interestingly, in 2006, we get even more coverage than 2005, although there aren't bad storms hitting the United States in that year. And why is that? It's because journalists decide this is a new beat and start paying a lot of attention to it. And in fact, here's another journalistic problem that occurs. There was a period where not a lot of science was coming out and there weren't a lot of storms to write about. So instead, what did journalists do? Well, scientists were arguing over this issue. There was a legitimate debate within the scientific community. And journalists started writing scientific controversy stories. And in the process, I think they actually exacerbated some of the fights between the scientists. And just one example, although this is, you know, I think there are many stories like this. Here's a Wall Street Journal front page story. Cold front, hurricane debate shatters civility of weather science. Worsened by global warming, dispatches so tempestuous, sides are barely talking, charge of brain fossilization. What's wrong with this? Well, scientists were fighting. It's not inaccurate to say that they were arguing over this subject, but focusing all the time on controversy and conflict is one way of doing a story, but there are other, perhaps more productive ways of writing a story, such as what are the policy implications? We actually don't know all we need to know right now about the relationship between hurricanes and global warming, but what we do know is our biggest source of hurricane vulnerability in the United States is what scientists have termed our lemming-like march to the sea, putting people and property in harm's way, and they'll get clobbered whether or not global warming is changing hurricanes. So the press could have been saying that the scientific debate will sort itself out. Meanwhile, the implication is just start protecting yourself and worry about a global warming-induced intensification further down the line once we're actually better protected to begin with. But no, it was just sort of a controversy, fighting kind of coverage. So there are many other problems in media coverage besides phony balance. And I'll just show you one more. I think some of my other colleagues on the panel have already made this point. But when it comes to this is a very interesting data that comes from Pew, which is about what the media was covering in two successive weeks, the week of January 29th of this year and February 5th. And the reason it's important is that the IPCC report, the summary for policymakers, came out on February 2nd. For some reason, the scientists released it on a Friday, which is a good way to not get covered. But you see that the week of January 29th, which included February 2nd, you had global warming. It looks like it was number four in terms of media attention, and people being really interested in it was number three. But then a week passes, and suddenly global warming has been knocked off, and what has come on? Well, Anna Nicole Smith, the Super Bowl, and the astronaut love triangle. This is the way the press works. And what is the consequence? Well, despite the record attention to global warming in 2006, at least in these two US agenda-setting newspapers, and I as well do not know as much about Canadian patterns of coverage, so I'm limiting myself to the US. We do have rising attention, but nevertheless, despite this record attention, in the United States, there's still a major partisan difference on the global warming issue. In fact, another Pew, this time a survey, found that 23% of college-educated Republicans in the US, only 23%, think global warming is happening due to human activity, as opposed to 75% of Democrats. So when Al Gore says it's not a Democrat-Republican issue, it's a moral issue, I don't think he's being quite candid. I actually think it's a moral issue and a Democrat-Republican issue, and you can infer what that might say about Republicans. Moreover, most Americans still rank global warming as less of a priority than over a dozen other issues that are more, and this is very different from the situation in Canada. And those other issues include not only the Iraq war, but tax cuts, the budget deficit, and so forth and so on. So we have a long way to go here. But as I think has already been hinted, there are certain pathologies in media coverage, okay? We know them. There's phony balance. There's paying attention to fluff rather than covering things in a more substantive way. There are lots of problems here in the media. Some say it has a political bias. I think it has a bias toward drama, controversy, and ratings, and that's problematic enough. But let's admit that the media is not the only problem. I think that scientists, science advocates, science defenders, environmentalists, we also have a responsibility to better frame and explain the global warming issue to the public and reach the public and make the media cover the issue in a different way by being persuasive. And we haven't done that either. So we have our work cut out for us as well. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Kirk?
I have a 75-slide presentation. Thanks. We can go to that now. No, I guess I'll try to avoid being the human pinata here tonight and view my role actually as the more parochial provider of the Canadian media perspective on global climate change. I'm not going to try to go toe-to-toe with science or academia or even our American guests who are going to provide a more international vista. So I'm going to confine my remarks to what I think the performance of the Canadian media has been and the role ahead, I think, for Canadian journalism, which I think is a slightly different role than the one south of the border. I think the most obvious thing to say is that 2006 was the year, finally, that everyone in our craft got it. It was long overdue. It was partly due to the glut of extreme weather, even locally here, that made us wonder about why it was happening so often and conclude finally what it was. I mean, obviously, partly there were external factors from America. It was the movie featuring Al Gore. It was the aftermath of Katrina. But also it was partly the election of Stéphane Dion as a Liberal leader, which then led to a swift shift of policy in the Conservative minority government to build some kind of political authenticity with a series of proposals, something I actually don't think they would have done in a majority government with years to go before an election. Partly was also a reawakening of our provincial government to recognize that the public mood had changed considerably and that it was time to jump onto it. Another obvious thing I think to say, and I'm a little surprised at the way that our panelists are so far framing it, because I actually don't find any great news in this. The media didn't get it first. And I'm not so sure that that's all that new. The movement of concerned citizens and scientists and activists and officials got it first. And once the expert public managed to find a way to frame issues in a way that our audiences say that they wish to receive them, the message got through. Media got it, then eventually politicians got it. You know, history actually suggests media are never at the vanguard of any shift in society. I think it's a bit of a myth that somehow we're out in front. The first environmental movement in the 1970s, it took years for media to even come close to catching up to it. The public is ahead of us almost every time. I mean, in football parlance, you know, we're not the quarterback engineering the play, nor the wide receiver who gets downfield first. We tend to be the running back carrying the ball in behind this lumbering offensive line, and we often fumble as we're on our way. And of course, we are skeptical, deeply skeptical of zealots and those possessed of singular passion. It's in our DNA to actually to challenge them. And we don't easily believe that zealots can be right. So there was no shortage of that skepticism and no shortage of airtime and space for their detractors in the run-up to the breakthrough on climate change coverage. And I expect that rearguard action is going to continue. And I don't view those contrarian assertions as necessarily unhealthy as long as they don't prevail, because I think, again, the public has discounted a lot of that white noise and has moved on to this issue. But something clearly changed this year, and I personally, as a print guy who's worked in television, I actually credit the visual media, television and film, as the tipping point in this case. Print journalism, I think, for years has been chronicling climate change, and chronicling it, despite what these charts say, reasonably well. I mean, in our paper alone, there were something like 700 stories in the last 3.5 to 4 years with climate change attached to them somehow. You know, we've probably spent hundreds of pages of newsprint on the issue in the time. But television really needs pictures to do its job. And I think the weather, and to a lesser extent, the political ascension of Stéphane Dion and the political controversy of Stephen Harper's first lamentable environment minister, and then his subsequent political covering of the tracks, that coverage, I think, gave TV the images it needed to tell the story. And so, unfortunately, now we have something akin in this country to political concurrence on the existence of the problem, if not concurrence on its causes or remedies. I think we've seen a stronger and stronger performance of Canadian journalism in recent months, and while it has taken time, I hear this, and now feels like opportunities were missed to be more credible a lot more earlier, I think at least now we're on the right track. And there's a broad acceptance and broad presentation of the issue. It has not been daily journalism's finest hour, but believe me, I would lose count of identifying worse hours that we've had in missing the point on things. If I worry at all, it's on two fronts. First of all, politicians are tripping over each other right now to outdo themselves. And that takes one of the necessary frameworks of journalism, conflict, out of the equation. And it's particularly neutralizing for television, which has a slightly greater need for black and white and has more difficulty operating in the zone of gray. And of course, there's going to be political debate about the particular causes of climate change. But the main debate is going to be on how to address it, which options should be pursued or not, how to continue to prosper while getting our houses in order, and who should pay for it, and how. Our next federal and provincial elections will give us an opportunity for a great discussion on the respective approaches. Now, I don't happen to feel personally that it's going to swing the vote, but I think it will be part and parcel of the debate. But I fear that many of these matters aren't going to make for great TV. And this issue really needs TV to entrench public and thus political momentum for change. Second worry I have is about the skill set of Canadian journalism. I don't think it's a stretch to suggest that the journalistic handling of the climate change issue may very well be what we are most judged on in the coming decade. So we're going to be challenged as never before, because the climate change issue is not merely, as I think we've heard tonight, it's not merely a monstrous scientific issue. That would be enough, because our newsrooms are insufficiently schooled in our sciences. But it's a phenomenal socioeconomic issue involving choices with trillions of dollars in consequences and substantial cultural shifts in behavior. We're going to need a more formidable understanding of macroeconomics and public policy in our newsrooms. It's also a powerful geopolitical issue that could conceivably lead to military conflict. It is possible we will need to be ready in our lifetime in journalism for the war over a water supply, or on pollution, or on resourcing. So journalism is going to be tested on this, and I think journalism has an opportunity here to earn a new respect and to reclaim some of its lost trust with a shrewd investment in the resources to scrutinize corporate, political, and social conduct. It is going to mean more attention to freedom of information to extract government records. It's going to mean more insight into business practices and multinational behavior. And I often say that it takes big media to withstand the pressures around these kinds of big stories, but I also think, in this case here, small media will be extremely helpful in this. And I even think that the Wikimedia approach, where experts will weigh in as journalists do their work online, will play a role in the next 3 to 4 years. I think what will happen is it will tweak for media organizations to commit the resources to it when they actually see it the way that we have in the last couple of years at The Sun. And I hate to sound shameful about this to people, but it is true. You know, we are a business, but we've actually found now that this is good business for us. I don't understand that there's any kind of failing in that, but I know people get very uncomfortable when they hear the profit motive in this. But we actually see it now as something that is going to attract audiences, make them more loyal, and eventually appeal to our advertisers who are going to want to reach a really sophisticated audience that wants true information. That, there's nothing really wrong with that. I think that's a very virtuous circle. So, to conclude, you know, for many of us, journalism is a calling. But this issue in itself is a calling to journalism. I wish I could say tonight that we're getting ourselves prepared, but I think we're simply all in the stage of reeling from the prospects. Thanks.
You have been listening to an expert panel debating the state of the media and climate change. The speakers were James Hogan, a public relations expert who founded dsmogblog.com, Hadi Daulatabadi, Professor, Institute of Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at UBC, Ross Gelbspan, reporter and author of Boiling Point, Chris Mooney, journalist and author of The Republican War on Science, and Kirk Lapointe, managing editor of the Vancouver Sun, the city's largest newspaper. Visit the University of British Columbia School of Journalism site at www.journalism.ubc.ca and dsmogblog at dsmogblog.com. This was recorded by Paul Donovan of Focus Audiovisual and Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. All five presentations by the panelists, their discussion among themselves, and the question and answer period for this event are available for free download from www.ecoshock.org.